1320 AM, W248DE, Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacey Lynn. President Biden is promising to return to the campaign trail next week, even as more Democrats urge him to step aside. Representative Greg Landsman of Ohio told CNN,
a big part of his legacy should be him stepping aside and allowing for that new leadership.
CBS's Willie James Inman is in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, where the president is isolating as he recovers from COVID.
More than 30 Democratic lawmakers have called for President Biden to step out of the race. Those calls growing even while the commander-in-chief recovers from COVID-19. On Friday alone, just over a dozen Democrats urged Biden to end his campaign.
Meantime, the GOP Trump-Vance ticket will be holding a rally later today in Michigan. CBS's Bradley Blackburn tells us,
will be held inside an arena 1 week after the assassination attempt against former President Trump.
As the nation still reels from that shooting, research shows political violence is on the rise.
A national poll from the University of Chicago's Chicago Project on Security and Threats finds that millions of people think the use of force is justified in some elections. Project Director Robert Pape.
Those statistics say that we are in quite a tinderbox of a country.
10% think the use of force is justified to keep former President Trump from retaking the White House, and 7% think it is justified to restore him to the presidency.
And you can hear the full interview with Allison Keyes on the CBS News Weekend Roundup podcast. Longtime Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas has died after a battle with pancreatic cancer. She was a fixture in Congress for nearly three decades and decided to run for mayor of Houston last year, but lost.
What kind of city are we going to be? How are we going to treat the people of this city? How are we going to improve the quality of life? Is this going to be a livable city?
The Clintons issuing a statement calling her a fearless fighter for the people of Houston, one of our country's most effective leaders, and a wonderful friend. Well, things are starting to recover and get back online after that massive IT outage yesterday. It was caused when security company CrowdStrike issued an update, but it knocked out Microsoft systems. So how can businesses lower their risk of an outage like this, putting them out again?
Security experts we spoke with say corporate IT departments should really consider diversifying their network security between multiple companies. So if there's a problem with one of them, it won't take down all of their computers at once.
That's CBS's Carter Evans. The CEO of CrowdStrike says they're working to find out why it happened and how to prevent it from ever occurring again. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Seth here, host of Over the Back Fence. We're on the air live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., taking your calls to buy or sell, talk local events, or whatever, only on WFHR.
Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Nationwide, community college enrollment grew by 100,000 students last year, and a large percentage of them were from lower-income neighborhoods. Here's Deborah Van Fleet.
At Western Nebraska Community College, TRIO Programs Director Tanya DeWitt says a number of their students who qualify for the federally funded program designed to help students with economic and other challenges has definitely increased. TRIO students must be a first-generation college student, have a household income not exceeding 150% of the federal poverty guideline, or have a disability. TRIO participants receive academic assistance, and DeWitt says many benefit from the Growth Mindset program.
Instead of, I can't do it, well, you can't do it right now, sure, but you can. All those negative, immediate, oh, well, no, I can't do nursing. Well, why is that? I just can't. Well, that's not true. So let's get to the bottom of it. Let's see what that is that's keeping you from being able to be successful.
DeWitt says the academic supports include in-person tutoring, 24/7 virtual tutoring, study guides, and online programs that assist with writing and research. She says the nursing program is very popular with TRIO students, and interest in the trades offerings is also growing. DeWitt says the ability to access tutoring any hour of the day or night, including holidays, is huge for some of their TRIO students.
We have the ones that are single parents in the middle of the night. That's when they're doing their homework.
Roughly 10% of WNCC's TRIO students are single parents. The Institute for Women's Policy Research reports that a large percentage of college students who are parents face enormous barriers to academic success, many of them economic. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. I'm Deborah Van Fleet. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Partly sunny in your forecast for today. I'm Corey Hartman. A high near 81 with a chance of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm. For tonight, mostly cloudy, lows around 60. Some storms are possible. For Sunday, a scattered storm or two. Otherwise, partly sunny and highs around 78.
It's 73 at our studios.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, Trigvi Olson from the Lincoln Project gives a convention review from Republicans hoping to reclaim their party someday from Trump extremists.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids' home of Nightlight with Peach Waba.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, this is Amicus Law Review. This, our second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast about all things justice-related, government-related, rule of law-related, spending much of our first hour chatting about this major decision coming out of South Florida by Eileen Cannon, dismissing the Mar-a-Lago documents case, getting rid of the prosecution against three of the defendants, including Donald Trump and two others there, and raising again in the national attention this issue of whether or not Jack Smith is properly constituted under the Constitution and statutes of our nation, a position that has been affirmed repeatedly by the Supreme Court and by other district courts over the period of decades, establishing clearly that Eileen Cannon, although she tries to distinguish her situation from those other cases, dismissing much of what those other courts have said as dicta, meaning not really the compelling substance of those cases, nonetheless, a decision that flies in the face of all of those other opinions and getting rid of the case in front of her. Significantly, of course, this decision, finding that Jack Smith out of the district court there in South Florida does not have the authority. Also seeing some tendrils, some waves coming out of that in other areas. Certainly going to be raised again in front of Tanya Chutkan. We know as well that she has got the responsibility to handle now this election interference case that's been pending in front of her for a long time, suspended by the Supreme Court, addresses other issues, including immunity and statutory basis for proceeding. She will also now have in front of her another renewed motion by defense counsel asking that Jack Smith be thrown off the case there as well. She will certainly deny that motion. I suspect fully that she will embrace all of the tradition that has been happening out there for years and deny that request. But note also that the president's own son, Hunter Biden, in his cases that are pending, also brought by special counsels, his name is David Weiss, he has now renewed his claim in those two courts that those cases be dismissed against him on the same basis, pointing to Eileen Cannon's decision and saying, gee, if it works in South Florida, why should it not work in Delaware and in California? Unlikely the district court judges in those cases will embrace what Eileen Cannon has said and say, yes, indeed, you're right, Hunter Biden, we've got to get rid of these cases as well. But it does have those tendrils and is being advanced by defense counsel to stop the further prosecution of those cases as well. Always affirming the capacity, the obligation of defense counsel in our system, the important role that they play to advance those arguments. Even if in the end they're unsuccessful, that's what our process is all about. Simply noting that the identification of this issue as being significant and material by Eileen Cannon when it is not is also giving rise to more litigation in these other areas. Also giving rise to some of the president's recent concerns about the Supreme Court, where at least this idea of special counsel authority had some beginnings with the concurrence of Associate Justice Clarence Thomas right before the change of the hour here on Amicus Law Review, talking about President Biden's indication that sometime soon he is going to be presenting a package of things to be considered by the American people, by the Congress, in addressing challenges presented by the actions, both judicial and non-judicial, of the Supreme Court, proposing presumably a constitutional amendment that would rescind, overtake this recent decision of the Supreme Court that finds that a president has immunity, the current president, Joe Biden, expressing outrage that that would be the case, instead embracing 248 years of history and saying we've got to get this clarified and we've got to get the decision by the Supreme Court, the six members of our Supreme Court who think that the president is in fact a king. We've got to get that restated in the Constitution. We didn't have to do that, presumably. It's implicit, if not explicit, in the very way the Constitution is set up. But if we need to do it, the president says, let's do it. And he is presumably going to propose a constitutional amendment, a heavy lift because of the mechanism by which that would be accomplished. Other things, however, that he's also presumably going to propose may require also a lot of activity, a lot of engagement, a lot of agreement, which probably doesn't exist inside the Congress right now, but not the heavy lift of a constitutional amendment. Also suggesting term limits. Term limits. Now, we've talked a lot in this broadcast and in other broadcasts of civic media about this notion that under the Constitution, our federal judges, district judges, federal judges at the appellate level, and the justices of the Supreme Court have had lifetime terms in office, lifetime tenure, based upon this language in the Supreme Court that says that they will serve there as long as they're engaged in good behavior. That's the way James Madison wrote it. That has been interpreted for a long period of time as meaning lifetime tenure to this day. And some of the legislative proposals do not rescind that notion, but say, you know what, let's create term limits even inside that concept. A senator named Sheldon Whitehouse, Dick Durbin, also from Illinois, have advocated for some legislation that would say, we're not going to strip you of your position as a Supreme Court justice. You will still stay there for life. We're simply going to redefine the time period in which you're going to be serving on the nine members court itself, making decisions on behalf of the nation. We may assign you to some other duties and tasks as a continuing Supreme Court member, but others are going to take your position after, say, 10 years or 15 years, whatever the term limit might be in that legislation. It is a very interesting concept. It may or may not run afoul of the Constitution, but it's a proposal, obviously, that is being articulated seriously by members of Congress and also presumably now by the President of the United States of America to address some of the concerns that he has seen in the United States Supreme Court, the possibility of legislatively establishing term limits inside the constitutional parameters of the Supreme Court's authority. And there's a second one that's also accessible by legislation. And that is the establishment and enforcement of a code of ethics. We have talked about that so much on this broadcast. The need for a uniform, enforceable code of ethics that applies not only for recusals of justices when they have personal and professional conflicts of interest, which we've identified, when they have engagements with individuals who appear in front of them, other sorts of things, subject matter that their spouses may be involved in, all of those kinds of things, and then more generally, the sources of their income, gifts given to them, vehicles, trips, all those kinds of things, reporting obligations, a uniform code of ethics that does indeed apply to lower court judges in the federal system, district court judges like Eileen Cannon, federal appellate court judges like those in the Seventh Circuit, in our circuit here in Wisconsin and Indiana and Illinois. Proposal also for the establishment of a legislative code of ethics. Now, we know that at least one justice of the Supreme Court, Sam Alito, has expressly said, you can't do that. Stay away. There's no authority in the Constitution to do that. The Chief Justice has declined efforts by the Senate to call him to a committee meeting and talk about this possibility. And he himself, while he's assembled kind of an amalgam of standards for behavior by the Supreme Court, he has expressly rejected this notion of a legislative imposition of a code of ethics. The president now appears to be suggesting in his forthcoming package that he would recommend that Congress go down that road. If they do it, the legislation happens. Again, a big lift given the present composition of Congress, but nonetheless that he would sign it. President, however, also indicating it's unlikely to embrace what's the most radical idea right now being pushed by some of the activists out there, and that is packing the court, increasing the number of justices, which has been done and can also be done legislatively. Our court has been as low as 5, proposals to increase it as much as 11. You can set the numbers of justices on the Supreme Court based upon, again, legislative decision-making. Both houses of Congress pass legislation establishing the number at a certain numeric level and having that legislation passed by the Congress, and then presumably a president enabled to nominate with the advice and consent of the Senate people to fill those positions. President apparently not going to go down that road. He said if we start the process of trying to expand the court, we're going to politicize it maybe forever in a way that is not healthy. And he said that in an interview with MSNBC not too long ago, personally not a part of his proposal. And yet, among the things that legislatively could be done, certainly proposals in Congress to do all of that. Major, major things underway right now when it comes to the Supreme Court and other things related to the interaction between the people of the United States of America, the decisions being made by the Supreme Court, the actions of the Supreme Court members themselves, and the ways in which we understand the rule of law in America. We always appreciate your comments and your questions. We've got Mark from Perry Dussac, who's been on the line for a while. Mark, glad to have you with me for your question or inquiry about our subject this morning.
Yeah, thanks so much. And the whole good behavior thing is mentioned, and you know, part of the whole presidential immunity thing and for the justices thing was actually discussed in the Federalist Papers.
Of course,
and 75
right?
For the president, where it was talking about an avaricious or ambitious man being chief magistrate, as they described it. But further to go on with in Federalist 81. You know, Hamilton actually talks about, you know, that the Supreme Court, you know, might get to a point where they make decisions that are uncontrollable and remediless. That because if the Supreme Court is assumed to have that much power, I mean, that was one of the concerns that the people had. Hamilton was addressing their concerns about in the upcoming Constitution, you know, in response to the Anti-Federalists, who were afraid that we would have courts like we had in the days of the monarchy, where the courts were bribable, where they were corrupt, where the monarch could just say, you do this for me, and this is what I want to see a decision reached. And that flies in the face of even in antiquity for judges to accept bribes, because in ancient Persia, you know, corrupt judges were executed by the king. I mean, that it is just... where bribery is actually mentioned in the Constitution as something that could get you impeached, removed from office.
Right, right.
This current Supreme Court has decided, well, those aren't bribes. They're just gratuities. Right. Well, I say BS to that, because, and ironically, with the new Supreme Court decision saying that Fed agencies don't have the power to regulate, you know,
right,
certain conduct
right.
at all, why does the FCC have the authority to regulate the content, what I can say on the air right here, what I can't use George Carlin's whole panoply, you know,
all kinds of things, all kinds of things, Mark, out there, right? Recent decisions, you make reference to this opinion that we've discussed also coming out of the Seventh Circuit, describing the difference between a gratuity and bribery. All those kinds of things, presumably, in the focus of the present president as he thinks about remedies, as you think about them, as we all consider the United States Supreme Court. I'm going to talk a little bit more about other cases coming up for the court when Amicus, a law review, continues here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
Skilled trade workers are the backbone of every community and also the Army National Guard.
Soldiers train to keep the power flowing, engines running, and in every other trade needed to accomplish the mission. These soldiers are on the fast track to learning skills that can set them up for success at home with companies looking to hire the best. Their resumes are being built through their paid training and part-time service. Find out how you too can learn a trade profession by visiting NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
It's 2024 and Worthington, Minnesota continues to shine. We've expanded so many things. It's a time of growth. We've expanded recreation activities with our indoor ice arena, our indoor turf rec center and playground, and our outdoor water park, Waterworld, is ready for another season. Our schools have expanded and so has our industry. We're continuing to expand our population also, with lots ready to build on Glenwood Heights. So let's grow together in Worthington, Minnesota. It's worth a look.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Taking calls here at 844-967-2789. Max and I also accepting your inquiries by dropping a line. Drop us a note in the Civic Media app. Let us know your question, your inquiry about what we're talking about here this morning. Mark, right before our previous discussion here, also expressing great concerns about the Supreme Court. Its efforts not only to identify what the law is and is not in America, but also doing things in ways that raise issues about its integrity and other concerns that, Mark, many other Americans raise these days. We know that all of this is happening, including the president's forthcoming proposals to, as he says, do something with respect to the Supreme Court. All this happens as the Supreme Court right now beginning to populate its docket for the current term, the future term. Even during this current term, it's got about 20 cases altogether right now on its docket. Recently added about six more. Let me tell you a little bit about those six cases, things we're going to be chatting about probably next time this year, the same kind of period, May, June, July, perhaps, as we think about what the Supreme Court's having on its docket. Just a few weeks after we observe the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landing, Supreme Court is going to be taking up again, as indicated, some issues related to international law. At the issue in a case called Republic of Hungary versus Simon is the interpretation of something called the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, that's a law that generally prevents lawsuits against foreign governments in U.S. courts, but it carves out one exception. And that big exception is known as the expropriation exception. And that basically says when the lawsuit involves property that's taken in violation of international law, and secondarily, there's a commercial connection between that property and the United States. The plaintiffs in this particular case allege that the Hungarian government took their property, they sold it, that they put the proceeds from the sales of that in some general state government treasury, and later used those funds from the treasury in connection with the country's commercial activities here in the United States. They're plainly understanding what this exception, the expropriation exception, is all about. A federal appeals court in D.C. agreed that these allegations are enough to establish a statement of claim here, unless the Hungarian government can show otherwise. And a court in New York ruled that the plaintiffs needed to show a more strong connection between the funds and the expropriated property. All of that now in front of the Supreme Court in its next term, case called Republic of Hungary versus Simon. It's another case, also fairly wonky, but equally important, if you will, United States versus Miller. It's a bankruptcy case. Agreeing to decide, the Supreme Court is a complicated bankruptcy question that arose under a particular mechanism for filing bankruptcy way back in 2017. The question there, whether the justices will determine about the power, once again, of the bankruptcy court. And indeed, the bankruptcy trustee, that's an office of the U.S. Department of Justice, has some responsibilities for justice and presentation of matters before bankruptcy courts. Whether the bankruptcy trustee can reverse a debtor's payment plan, a tax payment plan in particular, to the United States when there's no actual creditor in the bankruptcy, that could have obtained that relief. Fairly wonky, but important in terms of bankruptcy. We know just this past term that the court also took up this other bankruptcy case involving the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma, finding that the bankruptcy court did not have authority to enter into this omnibus bankruptcy plan that would have provided funding for recovery and also support for the victims and victim families of the opioid crisis. In a case written by Neil Gorsuch, an opinion written by him, the court saying no authority. We'll see in this other case, United States versus Miller. What is the authority of the bankruptcy court? What is the authority of the bankruptcy trustee in a situation where an actual creditor could not have obtained relief? What can the trustee do? There's another case called Feliciano versus Department of Transportation, involving in some ways, the rights of civilians and also people involved and who are protecting our nation as our soldiers in the armed services. The justice agreed recently to weigh in on this question, whether a federal civilian employee, somebody in the civil service who's called to active military duty during a national emergency, is qualified to receive what's called differential pay. Differential pay is the difference between compensation for your civilian pay and the military pay. If there's a difference between those, are you entitled to receive that differential pay even if the duty that you're called up to do is not directly connected to the specific national emergency? The question comes to the court in the case of Nick Feliciano versus Department of Transportation, which of course is where he works. He's an air traffic controller. He was called to active duty in the Coast Guard, where he manned a vessel in and around the Charleston, South Carolina harbor. An interesting question about payment for our military service soldiers and others, in this case, in the Coast Guard, called up to active duty. Another case called Stanley versus City of Sanford, California, a case involving the Americans with Disabilities Act. Supreme Court had one of those cases this past year, basically dismissed it because as it was moot, as the petitioner there did not pursue the claims. In this case, Stanley versus Sanford, Florida, justice is going to be considering a question arising under the ADA. Does a former employee lose her right to sue over discrimination in the provision providing benefits that she earned while she was employed? The question specifically comes up in this particular case involving Karen Stanley. She worked as a firefighter for the city of Sanford, thus the plaintiff and the defendant, for more than two decades or so before Parkinson's disease forced her to retire. She filed a lawsuit under the ADA, and she's alleging that the city's benefits policy discriminated against her in receiving disability benefits as a retiree. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit ruled that she was not a qualified individual protected by the ADA because she was not currently employed by the city. That's the 11th Circuit saying she's not entitled to those benefits. The court now determining whether the Americans with Disabilities Act does, in fact, give Karen Stanley the capacity, the ability to get those benefits. Another case involving the environment, also much on the docket of the Supreme Court this past term, as it found that the Biden administration could not do this Clean Air Act package of things having to do with polluted airs drifting from one part of our country to another. It's so-called Good Neighbors Plan, finding that that is not supported by the law, not supported by established rules of the EPA. The court once again taking up another environmental case, this one called Seven County Infrastructure versus Eagle County. Seven County Infrastructure versus Eagle County. Whether the National Environmental Policy Act, called NEPA, requiring federal agencies to examine the environmental effects, as they always do, of proposed actions by the federal government and to inform the public, you and me, of the environmental issues that it considers when making its decisions. Does that law, NEPA, does it require the agency to study environmental impacts beyond the immediate effects of the action that the agency has authority to regulate? How far can they go in studying these environmental impacts? Question comes before the court in a challenge to the scope
of that particular law. All of that coming up before the Supreme Court very soon as we consider more about what's on the docket of the United States Supreme Court here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Matt Nair on air.
CBS News Brief. President Biden is recovering from COVID in Rehoboth, but CBS's Willie James Inman reports his team says he's returning to the campaign trail next week.
The Biden campaign insists the president will stand strong. Despite the intense public and private pressure, the campaign says the majority of the Democratic Party stands with President Biden.
The nation is mourning the loss of Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, a fierce fighter for racial and human rights, who died last night after a battle with pancreatic cancer. CBS's Jeff Glor.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said, quote, she fought for the least, the lost, and the left behind.
The recovery from that CrowdStrike global tech outage is far from over, but CEO George Kurtz tells CNBC,
we'll do the hot wash on how this happened and ensure it doesn't happen again.
The company says there was no cyber attack, and the problem began with a faulty system update that affected Microsoft Windows computers. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Bucks player has surgery. I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks' Andre Jackson recovering from surgery on his left hand. He suffered a fracture in his left ring finger last week in a game. Should be all right by the time the team plays game one of the season. The Bucks now 0-4 after losing to Phoenix yesterday 115-90. Up next, they play the Wizards this afternoon in Las Vegas. Baseball resumes tonight for the Brewers in Minnesota against the Twins. NFL, the Packers have released former backup quarterback Alex Magoo. The team had asked Magoo about switching from quarterback to wide receiver, but released him anyway. Former Packers wide receiver Donald Driver at Racine Case High School, where over 500 kids showed up for his football camp.
So a lot of these kids, this would be their first time running. This is the first time trying to just learn how to run and jump. And so if we can teach them to change the direction, we give it to them early. It's funny because we were just talking about when I retired, and they was like, oh, I was just born.
That's Donald Driver with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Weather is sponsored by Econ Electric LLC, your neighborhood Generac generator dealership. Don't let bad weather affect your power. Visit Econ Electric in Wisconsin Rapids.
Partly sunny in your forecast for today. I'm Corey Hartman. A high near 81 with a chance of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm. For tonight, mostly cloudy, lows around 60. Some storms are possible. For Sunday, a scattered storm or two. Otherwise, partly sunny and highs around 78.
Currently, 75 degrees.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are in the ninth inning. Bases loaded and up to bat. Can you hear that crowd? Here we... Aww. What just happened? Everything is dark. The lights are back on. Look at that.
Yes, the team invested in Generac generators from Econ Electric, so no one will miss a moment. Econ Electric is your neighborhood big league pro in Generac generators. Call Econ Electric at 715-423-8440 today. Summer gatherings happen around the grill, so make sure whatever you're grilling is delicious and healthy. Family Natural Foods prides themselves in providing quality, free-range, hormone-free chicken, beef, shrimp, Alaskan salmon, and for something special, buffalo. All great for the grill. Family Natural Foods carries the summer family essentials, all-natural bug spray and sunscreen, flea and tick for your four-legged friends, and electrolytes to keep you hydrated. Family Natural Foods, your home for making this summer great. Family Natural Foods, West Grand Avenue, Wisconsin Rapids.
Do you need your home or garage cleaned? Then call Patty at Right Way Cleaning. Is your business or office kind of dirty? Call Patty at Right Way Cleaning. Whether you need cleaning daily, weekly, or seasonally, call Patty at Right Way Cleaning. Need help grocery shopping, laundry, cooking, house sitting, pet sitting? Call Patty at Right Way Cleaning. Power washing siding and decks, grass cuttings, raking leaves? Yep, that's right. Call Patty at Right Way Cleaning. Call 459-1475 anytime.
Summer is finally here and outdoor adventure awaits. Get your adventure rolling with a camper from Greenway RV. As a family-owned dealership with 9 top 50 dealer awards for excellent customer service, they know the importance of quality time with loved ones. Plus, as a Route 66 network dealer, you can travel with peace of mind knowing help is just a phone call away. So kick off your next adventure with Greenway RV. You know you're in good hands. 8220 Highway 13 South in Wisconsin Rapids or online at greenwayrv.com.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk to the Pewaukee Public Library about all the wonderful things going on there that you can take advantage of. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, talking again about the Supreme Court as we have for a long period of time here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, commenting in particular about the fact that the Supreme Court is now populating its docket for the next term, that is the 2024-2025 term. It's going to be taking up probably about 60, maybe 70 cases altogether. Already has on that docket about 20 such cases, anticipating likely a similar number as it has done in the past. We talked about this international case, government seizures, this bankruptcy case pending before the Supreme Court in the next term as well. Military office benefits, the Americans with Disabilities Act, an environmental case, and also another case called Dewberry versus Group Engineers. Justice is determining whether a plaintiff in an intellectual property case, if that plaintiff gets an award of defendant's profits, in other words, they file a lawsuit against someone who's violating their trademark, their copyright, and under a thing called the Lanham Act, we've talked about that from time to time, that's one of the federal statutes establishing intellectual property in the federal system, for a trademark violation, can that award include an order for the defendant, the person who violated the particular trademark intellectual property right? Can the award include a requirement that the defendant turn over the profits that he, she, or it acquired by a separate corporate affiliate that's not a part of the case, not a part of the formal litigation? An interesting trademark case, as again, going forward, this case called Dewberry Group, Dewberry Enterprises, a trademark case, also joining the others before the Supreme Court as it continues to populate its docket in the coming months, as it begins then in early October, its next term for the benefit of the American population, as it continues to attempt to resolve these many issues, big and small, important for all of us to understand, obviously greater importance depending upon the nature of the specific challenge and the lawsuit that ultimately comes before the court. We appreciate, we value, as always, your comments and questions, 844-967-2789. And we especially appreciate Jack calling in from Merrimack this weekend. Your question or inquiry or comment, Jack, glad to have you with me.
Yeah, this is fairly long, so feel free to interrupt me if you think you need to. But I'm wondering, what's going on here? Lower courts, and canon in particular, ignoring precedents and statutes. Lower courts that tell the FDA that a drug is unsafe, ignoring decades of evidence, studies that show the opposite. Supreme Court ignores the legislation that establishes regulatory agencies and their ability to regulate, And to use experts that are objectively studied cases and use their evidence to regulate. Supreme Court so-called justices, having stated during their confirmation that precedents are established law, and then they ignore and reverse those precedents. Aren't those people under oath when they're under confirmation hearings? Isn't that perjury? So-called originalists, Federal Society Supreme Court justices, and they ignore the clear intent of the Founding Fathers in our Constitution that a president doesn't have royal rights to immunity for illegal acts. And they give a nearly blanket immunity for those acts. And even the president made a presentation of evidence for those illegal acts.
Right.
I thought even client-lawyer communications involving unlawful plans weren't subject to such confidentiality. And it's pretty clear from the Constitution the Supreme Court never intended to have this kind of power. They're not just making new interpretations of what some of them said was established law. They're changing the laws.
Right.
They're essentially stating that only they can do so. They're completely overstepping, in my opinion, the line between the separation of powers. And when Biden took office, I gave the opinion that he needed to do two important things at the top of his agenda. The first, given the egregious voter suppression and disenfranchisement that was going on, to pass the Voter Rights Act, but mainly this, since McConnell already stacked the court, to rebalance it by adding four more justices, which incidentally I think would be appropriate given there are 13 federal court districts. And let's not even get into the unapologetic and paid-for corruption of some of these justices.
And, Jack, I think that you expressed the frustration not only of the dissenters in many of these cases you've identified along the way, this notion that we are not only drop-kicking precedent, but we're overturning fundamental notions that are in the Constitution, not just because they're long-standing and not just because they're written there, but because they advance justice, right? And that's the concern. That's, yes, I think, what the president's concerned about. You've identified a number of these areas where I think Americans can legitimately say, what is going on here? And ask not just the rhetorical question that you've asked, but also, what do we do about it? You know, in the as we talked in recent broadcasts, we've got recommendations from at least a couple of the Supreme Court justices, especially in connection with the immunity case. This other one you made reference to, of course, that's the Loper Bright Enterprises, overturning the ways in which our administrative agencies work and their connection to the people and courts in particular. A recommendation from the dissenting justices that's now up to us. It's now up to the people, again, to articulate exactly what you've articulated, Jack, and to be out there and say, you know what, we need to do something differently here. I've commented in the past about how in Israel, as we have talked on this broadcast in the past, when they faced, long before the war right now blazing and going on in Gaza, between those forces there, long before that, when Benjamin Netanyahu proposed a significant diminution in the power of the courts, the people of Israel got out into the streets and they said, you know what? This is not the rule of law for our nation. This is not what we want. And they shut the country down. They shut down the airports. They shut down the streets, the academic institutions, commercial businesses. They kept medical offices and hospitals open only for non-elective surgery. And so all of those kinds of things makes you wonder if America needs likewise to respond at least to these recent matters that you've identified, virtually all of them, in which the court is moving beyond fundamental notions of justice and also expressing, I think it's implicit, if not explicit, what you just said, Jack, a real contempt, as I've talked before, about the basic institutions of our system of justice. The decision in the Trump case suggesting that grand juries and pretrial rulings and jury instructions, all the other trappings of what we anticipate in any criminal case, are simply no longer good, at least not good enough for a president. All good points, Jack, and notion that we need to respond to this as people in the country who are concerned about this movement. The president concerned, obviously others in Congress, others on courts are also concerned. All of us need to be a part of the response to what you've identified. Appreciate so much the comment and the encouragement to do something more. We take Jack's good thought about the future of our nation, and we also talk about what happens in our courts when the justice system works properly and when, in fact, things happen in the courts, our civil courts, our criminal courts. Admittedly, especially in the criminal setting, as I've commented in so many instances, all criminal prosecution is human tragedy. Commented about that a lot. We know that just this past week, that played out again, actually past month or so, when Senator Robert Menendez, New Jersey, powerful Democrat, prosecuted by the Department of Justice, formerly Robert Menendez, still on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, question about whether or not he will continue in the United States Senate in the wake of his conviction for participating in a vast international bribery scheme, again, brought by the Department of Justice, not by special counsel, but by line attorneys in the criminal division, in the public corruption section. Prosecutors said he accepted gold and cash and other payoffs, hundreds of thousands of dollars in exchange for political favors, both abroad and at home. Abroad, that's the Egypt connection. A Manhattan jury returning just this past week, deliberating about 13 hours or so over 3 days in the federal court there,
finding Robert Menendez guilty on 16 counts, bribery, honest services wire fraud, extortion, obstruction of justice, conspiracy, and yes, acting as an agent for Egypt, a jury. The process went forward. A judge presiding over that case named Sidney Stein, a jury determining in the end that there is indeed proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Senator Robert Menendez engaged in this conduct. He becomes the first U.S. senator ever to be found guilty of acting as an agent of a foreign power. Again, that foreign power is Egypt. Seventh in our history to be convicted of a federal crime in office. It is tragic, not only for him, not only for the people of New Jersey, for all of us, but it also sends some messages in the way that the now convicted defendant responded to all of this. He has indeed, up to now, resisted calls to step down, and we'll see what he does in the future. That may, in fact, happen. He is pondering that right now, but it's important to take a look at what he said after this verdict. The things that he said that are appropriate in contrast to other things that another defendant has said in another setting that are inappropriate. Here's what Senator Menendez, just convicted of these offense conduct in the federal district court, said he was deeply, deeply disappointed by the jury's decision. Said that he has every faith that the law and the facts do not sustain the decision. He'd be successful on appeal. He said, "I've never violated my public oath. I've never been anything but a patriot in my country and for my country. I've never been a foreign agent." Now, all of that are things that we not only anticipate, but we permit and we embrace defendants saying, continuing to maintain, even though the jury has found to the opposite. And yes, indeed, the presumption of innocence no longer attends him. He is a convicted felon in the federal district court. Still, the nature of what he says, note what he doesn't say. He doesn't attack the judge. That judge, again, Sidney Stein. He doesn't attack the jury for its deliberation. He doesn't call the process itself a sham, a witch hunt. He doesn't impugn the integrity of the prosecutor. The prosecutor is from the Department of Justice. He maintains his innocence. That's the kind of thing that we anticipate from defendants, even in the wake of a conviction. Does he have a right to appeal his judgment? Of course he does. And he's indicated he will do that. He will continue to maintain his innocence. That's the kind of thing that the First Amendment and the rights that are attended upon any defendant are all about in America. What Senator Menendez does not do, even in the wake of this horrific result for him, for New Jersey, for the Congress of the United States of America, and for all of us, what he doesn't do is he doesn't send messages to the United States of America and all of our citizens, 334 million of us, that the system is somehow broken and that this is a result of corrupt judges and bad jurors and tainted prosecutors and witnesses who lie and people who come into the court and do not, in fact, take their oath seriously. Significantly, two other businessmen, a fellow named Wal Hanna and Fred Dibes, also convicted, also part of the guilty counts in this jury verdict. Likewise, not attacking the system, maintaining their innocence, but not undermining the very structures by which all of this happens. Still, even in their protests about the nature of the conviction, the sentence to be imposed upon them by Sidney Stein, October 29th, carrying potential sentences of up to 20 years in prison. Even in the midst of all of that, this human tragedy, not attacking what Donald Trump has done in that Manhattan courtroom along the way, not requiring the imposition of an order by the judge, by Judge Stein, that he not talk about these people, understanding, as even Robert Menendez does, who plainly should no longer be a public servant, no longer be in the United States Senate, should now face the results of what he has done to compromise the basic duties and responsibilities that are his and others under our federal criminal code and under the basic trappings of public service. He's got to face all of that. But even in so, even doing that, even in the midst of that tragedy, he also implicitly, if not explicitly, does precisely what Donald Trump did not do in saying, when Donald Trump did say repeatedly, that all of this is the product of corruption. And so we take away that and other lessons from the Menendez conviction of conspiracy in this broad international charge against him. And then we also think about things overseas. And as we continue our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review, we're going to talk more about things happening overseas and contrast those with what's happening in our courts here in the United States of America as Amicus, a Law Review continues.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Tome for the Todd Allball Show.
Donald Trump brags he nominated the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, getting rid of the constitutional right to abortion.
Well, I did something that nobody thought was possible. I got rid of Roe v. Wade. For 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
Donald Trump not only took away abortion rights, he wants to monitor pregnant women and punish those who seek an abortion. Just listen.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
Banning abortion, monitoring and punishing women. That's how far Trump might go in a second term. Visit abetterwisconsintogether.org/TrumpMonitor to tell Donald Trump his views on abortion are too extreme for Wisconsin. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name, Jim Santel, talking about the ways in which courts administer justice here in our country and also in other places overseas. A couple of rule of law snapshots. We also know that there are courts both here in our nation and overseas that do embrace the concept of due process and notice and evidence and the predicates for ultimately delivering justice. We know just this past week that the United States Department of Justice has returned a major indictment against a former North Korean expert and someone who was with the Council on Foreign Relations and previously acted on behalf of many foreign policy entities, a woman named Sue Mee Terry, alleging, again, in a present indictment that she engaged in extensive activities for and at the direction of the South Korean government, did not register as a foreign agent. She faces two counts, one for failing to register as a foreign agent and the other for conspiring to violate. That comes out of a process in our system. She is still presumed innocent. A grand jury process that reviewed not only the specific facts here, understood the law as presented to it, and returned, again, not a finding of guilt, but a determination that the case should go to trial. That a part of our process. We also have another matter coming out of the International Court of Justice just late this past week. Again, a part of a process, not in our courts, but in the International Court of Justice on Friday of this past week, saying that Israel's occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, settlements there, violated international law, probably the most sweeping stance it's taken. The Israeli settlements, the court says, in West Bank and East Jerusalem, and the regime that was associated with them have established there and are being maintained in violation of international law. Now, all of that also the subject of contest and of disagreement and of argument, of evidence presented in both directions. We know that the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has dismissed that finding. And, of course, there are an awful lot of people who look at that on both sides, who embrace it and do, in fact, dismiss the finding. The point is, in both of these, both in our courts and also in the international court, there is a process that requires the presentation of evidence and judges making determinations, perhaps imperfectly, but also subject for review and appeals inside the Justice Department and also in the appellate views of the people generally. Contrast all of that to what we also saw this past week when a court in Russia, also on Friday, sentenced Evan Gershkovich, who's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, to 16 years in a high security penal colony, ending there the espionage case, but maybe opening up the possibility for his return there. The reason that this is so significant is because what happened along the way. Mr. Gershkovich, again, this reporter for the Wall Street Journal,
denying any charge of espionage, reporting in Russia, says nonetheless that he did not do anything in violation of law. The parent company of the Wall Street Journal describes the conviction as unsupported by the law, disgraceful, does describe it as a sham, and notes that we'll continue to do whatever we can do to press for Evan's release and support his family. The significant point behind all this is that there you do have a process, a court that plainly is not embracing all the other trappings of a process here. The court said that the totality of the evidence presented was sufficient to render a guilty verdict, and the court imposed this 16-year sentence based upon evidence that's far, far from clear. The release of the indictment last month was the first time that the Russian state had even revealed any details about the case, no transparency at all of the sort that we would have, and did not provide and still have not provided any specific evidence to back up this charge of espionage. The proceedings on Friday, both sides were given the opportunity to deliver some final arguments, were behind closed doors. Unlike our courts, unlike the other courts around the world in nations that embrace the rule of law, this one behind closed doors, we don't know what the charges were with specificity. We don't know what the evidence was. Journalists, like the defendant here, Evan Gershkovich, not permitted to be a part of the proceedings to watch what's happening. They came to the court building in about 900 miles from Moscow, not allowed to see the defendant in the courtroom. And the case actually sped up. Of course, about two or three hearings in recent days. It was announced the second hearing, probably hours, if that, in length, have moved ahead very quickly in the course of all of this. Plainly not enough time to do what we would call a trial, where there's evidence that attorneys can weigh and sift, that a judge, a court, can weigh and sift. The first hearing in the Gershkovich case took place in June. On Thursday, in the second hearing, the court wrapped up its investigation and the evidence, hearing witness testimony, and it was done. Now, as a result of all of this, it is very clear that the court not only accelerated its movement on this, but also reached this verdict, as I indicated, without any clear exposition of evidence to support this particular espionage charge, without the kind of deliberative review that we anticipate and that we contemplate and that we have seen in the processes in other courts, in federal courts, state courts, in our nation, and in others around the country. Now, the only good sign from all of that, the expedited and the summary nature of this, is it may be a predicate to the release of Mr. Gershkovich, if in fact the United States of America, through the State Department and others, through the president himself, decides to engage in a prisoner swap. And that could happen down the road. And that may well justify the expedited nature of this, but still, in its constitution, this kind of court, completely unknown to our system of justice there in Russia, that's the kind of thing that you get that is a sham court, that is a witch trial, if you will, a witch hunt, the kind of thing that Donald Trump ascribes to our courts unjustly, inappropriately. In Russia, you've got that, but not here in the United States of America. We note as well that a Moscow court has also sentenced recently a fellow named Michael Leek, an American rock musician, to 13 years in a high-security penal colony. And we also know that other Americans, including Paul Whelan, a Marine veteran, Alusu Kermaseva, an editor working for Radio Free Europe, and Mark Fogel, a teacher in the Anglo-American School in Moscow, all of them have been detained in Russia on various charges. And they're also plainly, the subject of consideration, not only about the ways in which justice is delivered there, but probably, certainly we know, behind the scenes attempts by our government to get their release in various ways, arguably involving swaps as well. We think about justice as we think today and this weekend and all times about the future of our courts, both international here in the United States of America. We invite your continued participation down the road as we continue to talk about the rule of law and government and justice here on Amicus, a Law Review. Thank you for joining me, everybody.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm live from Madison and welcome hilarious comedian Pat McGann and singer-songwriter Marta Hansen joins the show and performs live in studio.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
WFHR invites you to join David Farmbrough of Coldwell Bankers Seward Realtors and tune in to Let's Talk Real Estate. The next show is coming up and we'll be talking about topics that matter to you, whether you're a buyer or a seller. So if you're looking forward to welcoming David Farmbrough to the show and taking your questions, be sure to tune in every second Tuesday of the month right here on your locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and 1320 AM WFHR.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. This is locally grown radio, WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.